I hope that the other three are shaking in their boots, because they should be. They should have never, ever, ever did anything like this.
Eric Allmendinger is found guilty on all charges in the murder of Palmer teen David Grunwald. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two Native corporations want to look for oil in Anwar.
They submitted an application. We're reviewing it along with Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know, we'll process that permit application just like any other.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
A Palmer jury today found Eric Allmendinger guilty on all counts in the 2016 slaying of 16-year-old David Grunwald. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was in the courtroom and joins us by phone. Casey, give us a brief recap of the details in this murder trial that led up to today's guilty verdicts.
Yeah, so David Grunwald was 16 back in November of 2016, and he went missing. Nobody knew where he was for a couple weeks. They had previously found his burned-up Ford Bronco. And then one of the four people that was charged in his murder ended up leading troopers to his body over in the Butte. And what came out through the investigation and what was presented in court was that a group of teenagers had beaten Grunwald and then driven him to the spot in the Butte, and that one of them, we still haven't really seen evidence of who actually shot him, but they allegedly worked together to kill him, left him there, and didn't tell anybody about it for a couple weeks. That all led up to this first trial for one of the alleged accomplices, Eric Allmendinger, who, like you said, was found guilty today on all counts. And that includes murder, evidence tampering, arson, kidnapping, and assault.
What was the scene in the courtroom like today?
It was packed. There's been a lot of attention on this case. And today, what was a little different was we saw quite a few young people there that looked like friends and family of David Grunwald. There was also some people watching a live feed from outside the courtroom because there were so many people there. A lot of the folks in the courtroom were hugging David Grunwald's parents, including Edie Grunwald, his mom, after the verdict was delivered. And it was a big culmination, I would say, to a very high-profile murder case for Palmer, which is a pretty small community that doesn't see these kind of things happen very often.
Did Eric Allmendinger's lawyer say anything after the verdicts were announced?
No, his attorney, John Iannacone, left pretty quickly afterward. Interestingly, the prosecutor, Roman Kalachek, also did not comment. He said he didn't want to prejudice any potential jurors in the future, and that's because there are three other people who potentially could still stand trial for this murder.
Casey, David Grunwald's parents, Edie and Ben, have been in court every day of this trial. What was their reaction to the verdicts?
Edie was pretty subdued. She said that this never should have happened. We were standing just outside the courtroom, and she said that a couple times, that this never should have happened. She did say that law enforcement should have gone after these guys earlier, maybe for other alleged criminal activity. She said that some of their small-time criminal activity had just escalated to this point, that nobody had sort of nipped this in the bud, as she put it. I asked her about the prospect of having to sit through two or even three more trials. She said it had been tough, admittedly very hard to sit through two and a half weeks of this trial. There may be more trials to come, and she expects that'll still be tough, but she plans on being there. She said that they're in it for the long haul, that they need to do their part to hold these guys accountable. She also thanked the community for their support.
I hope that the other three are shaking in their boots, because they should be. They should have never, ever, ever did anything like this.
What about the other alleged accomplices?
Yeah, so that's Dominic Johnson, Austin Barrett, and Bradley Renfro. I believe Johnson is the next one scheduled for a trial. That would be in September, but those dates are often pretty fluid. Those things can change. It's hard to say who will be up next, or if there may be plea agreements even in the future now that this guilty verdict, these guilty verdicts have been entered. And it's also still unclear if they'll still be tried separately.
That was Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reporting from the courthouse in Palmer. Two Alaska Native corporations are asking the federal government if they can start looking for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and Koktovik Inupiat Corporation have submitted a 3D seismic exploration plan for the coastal plain, or the 1002 area. They partnered with oil exploration company SAE Exploration. The companies want to begin a substantial exploration program this winter, encompassing the entirety of the biologically rich coastal plain, potentially involving hundreds of workers. The corporation's permit application was first reported by the Washington Post. The Post also reports that Interior's Fish and Wildlife Service responded by saying the plan, as currently submitted, is not adequate because it didn't include proper studies on environmental effects. But after speaking at an oil conference in Anchorage today, top Interior official Joe Balash confirmed the agency is still considering the plan.
They submitted an application. We're reviewing it along with Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know we'll process that permit application just like any other.
Balash says a key thing Interior will consider is compliance with Endangered Species Act protections for polar bears. According to the Bureau of Land Management, the agency will make a decision on the application by July. Environmental groups condemned the news. In a statement, the Alaska Wilderness League said exploration, quote, would cause severe and long-lasting damage to the Arctic refuge, unquote. ASRC has not yet responded to a request for comment. Public meetings on oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge are drawing intense interest from Alaskans across the state. Last night, more than 100 protesters gathered outside the Anchorage meeting, including Samuel Johns, whose mother is from Arctic Village on the edge of the refuge.
I was in there just a little bit ago and I got to hear the first guy speak. And the first guy, no offense to y'all, but the first person in there to speak was a white man in support of ANWR, in support of development. To me, that's a slap in the face to my people.
At the meeting, officials said the Trump administration must move forward with oil lease sales in ANWR. The Department of Interior's Joe Balash said that's because of specific language in the law Congress passed last year allowing drilling in ANWR.
The statutory provisions say DOI shall.
Testimony at the meeting was mixed. Many protesters came inside to speak against development, citing effects to subsistence, the climate, and the value of untouched wilderness. Others with labor and industry groups spoke in favor of development. Jason Allward was there representing Operating Engineers Local 302.
The leases, the development, the production of ANWR's natural resources are vital to our future, and this project can be done responsibly.
The meetings ran more than 5 hours, but it still wasn't long enough to accommodate everyone who wanted to testify. The comment period officially ends June 19th. However, a Bureau of Land Management spokeswoman says the agency has received many requests to extend it. BLM is holding another public meeting on development in ANWR today in Utqiagvik. Additional meetings are planned in June in Koktovik, Vinatai, and Washington, D.C. Senator Lisa Murkowski says President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs aren't good for Alaska, and she's frustrated with the inconsistency in the administration's position.
When you have kind of a suggestion out there today and it turns into a promise the next day, and then after that it's never mind, that makes it difficult.
Alaska's senior U.S. senator says the tariffs could drive up costs for the oil and gas industry as well as construction projects at Alaska's military bases. She told reporters in Anchorage that Trump and his team need to craft clear policies and agree to them before they're announced.
Then that's what you go out and you sell. And Americans understand it, the Congress understands it, our friends understand it, our enemies understand it. But when we kind of go back and forth and forth and back, I think that's confusing. It's difficult from a governance perspective.
Murkowski also says she's frustrated that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt seems to be consumed by problems that she says are of his own making or his staff's.
And I think that that limits then his ability to be effective on the issues that we care about.
Pruitt is facing multiple investigations into his spending, travel, and transactions with lobbyists. Murkowski says he didn't have good answers when she asked him to explain himself at a hearing she chaired 2 weeks ago.
And I think he knows that is not, that's not sustainable for him to be able to lead that agency.
Senator Dan Sullivan is also critical of the tariffs. He issued a statement calling it a bad move to apply the import taxes on goods from U.S. allies like Canada and the European Union. U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, sent a letter to the U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Army today in regard to the permitting process for the proposed Pebble Mine. Cantwell asked that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers expand scoping for its environmental impact statement. Scoping is the opportunity for the public to suggest concerns and alternatives to the proposed mine plan as the Corps weighs the environmental impact of the Pebble project. Specifically, Cantwell requested public meetings in the state of Washington and an extended scoping period. In a statement, Cantwell said, quote, due to the importance of Bristol Bay fisheries to our economy, Washington fishermen, suppliers, and businesses have an enormous interest in ensuring that Bristol Bay salmon continue to thrive for generations, unquote. Cantwell has opposed Pebble Mine since 2014. There is 1 month left in the 90-day scoping period for the proposed mine. The U.S. Army Corps held 9 public meetings in Alaska in April, where more than 900 people participated. People can still comment on the project online or by mail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists wonder why cod stocks are plummeting.
As you get a number of years together, you can start to understand something about how environmental changes are affecting the population.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Heroin is an opioid known for risks of addiction and overdose, but prescription opioids such as hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine can also carry these risks. If you're prescribed an opioid for pain, ask your medical provider about the risks and ask about alternative treatments. Learn more about opioid safety at opioids.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The University of Alaska Anchorage has a new chancellor. In a press release yesterday, UA President Jim Johnson announced that Kathy Sandine will start in the fall. Sandine is currently the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin. She's had previous tenures in the University of California system, as well as vice president of education, attainment, and innovation at the American Council on Education. The chancellor position has been vacant since June of last year when Tom Case resigned from his position. Sam Gingrich has served as an interim chancellor during the gap. Johnson said in the release that his discussions with Sandine have, quote, convinced me that she understands the range of issues facing UAA. Among those issues are budget cuts. Since 2014, the UA system's annual budget has declined by more than $60 million. Sandine will begin her tenure 2 years into President Johnson's initiatives to cut costs and consolidate administration, dubbed Strategic Pathways. In a video introduction, Sandine says she is eager to help advance UAA's various goals.
I so appreciate the mission of student success and access, as well as providing relevant education and a connection with the community and the workforce and the economy of the surrounding region, as well as the whole state of Alaska.
Sandine is set to begin her new job on September 15th. On an island about 4 miles off of Kodiak, researchers are trying to figure out why Pacific cod stocks are crashing in the Gulf of Alaska and how climate change may be affecting the fish when they're young. KMXT's Mitch Borden caught a ride out with them on one of their trips and has the story.
Mike Litzo and his wife Alyssa Abukair are stuck.
We have to get some kelp out, Liz.
They're trying to pull in a beach seine on a soggy gray day on Long Island, but they're catching more seaweed than fish as they slowly sink deeper into the shore's mud.
Oh no. It's the freaking mother load.
Oh, man.
This will be our day right here, if we're not careful.
This isn't a normal fishing trip. Litzo and Abukair are both marine scientists, and they're collaborating on a study for the University of Alaska Fairbanks to figure out why Pacific cod stocks are declining in the Gulf of Alaska and how warming waters may be affecting the species when they're young. But to do that, they need cod to study, which is why they're currently struggling to pull in a net. When the seine's finally on shore, Litzo begins counting up the catch.
Oh, there's a fish.
Yeah, big dolly. Guessing? Nope. It's a greenling that Alyssa will identify.
There aren't any cod among the small flopping fish, but every specimen is still inspected and recorded before they're tossed back into the water. Litzo says he isn't surprised they're not catching any cod today because it's probably too early for them to come into shore. As it becomes warmer, though, more and more fish will begin to appear, including the small cod they're looking for.
So over the winter, you know, we would come out and we'd set five sets and we'd get, I think at the low point, like 15 fish. And then in the summer, if you hit a big school of fish, you know, you can get 15,000 fish in one set.
Once juvenile cod begin to show up in their net, Litzo and Abukair will measure them, examine the fish to figure out what they're eating, and he says collect the small ear bones, or the otoliths, of the cod, which will be used to determine the temperature of the water the fish grew up in.
So there's all kinds of information you can get sort of over time once you catch the fish.
The reason it's important to collect this data is the Gulf of Alaska has been unusually warm for the past few years. In that time, cod populations have crashed. Cod is an important commercial fishery in the Gulf, and the quota was recently cut by about 80% for 2018. Litzo says the unusually warm water in the Gulf is connected to climate change. And, he believes, the reason the cod population declined so quickly is that juvenile cod couldn't find enough food to sustain themselves in these warmer temperatures. But that's only a hypothesis right now, which is why Litzo and Abukair are trying to collect as much information that will help explain the collapse.
As you get a number of years together, you can start to understand something about how environmental changes are affecting the population. And that's the ultimate goal. But it does take a few years, you know, to get enough data to have to be able to answer questions like that.
Which means Litzo and Abukair will hopefully be taking a lot more trips to cast their net to see what more they can learn about how cod are being affected by the changing climate in the Gulf of Alaska. In Kodiak on Long Island, I'm Mitch Borden.
Salmon runs in the Norton Sound area are expected to be at least as strong as last year, with the exception of king or Chinook salmon. KNOM's Gabe Colombo has more.
We think things are going good, and we just don't want to be surprised with another crash.
That's Jim Menard. He's the Norton Sound and Kotzebue Area Fisheries Manager for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, or ADF&G.
The sun's shining right now, and we're counting on a good year, and the only long-term trend we have seen is the downward spiral of the king salmon.
According to the 2017 Fisheries Management Report, total Chinook catch numbers haven't been above 1,000 since 1999, except in 2015. The record is nearly 20,000 fish in 1997. Menard says ADF&G isn't sure exactly why the decline has happened since then, but he says it probably has to do with ocean conditions.
Because it's occurring across such a wide area of landmass, we're sowing our seed. We think we're getting enough kings on the spawning grounds with the restrictions we're having. So that's why it points to something out in the ocean, that there's some sort of problem with the kings, whereas, you know, it's worked well for the other species.
That's especially true for silver or coho, as well as chum salmon. Last year's commercial coho harvest set a record, and the chum harvest was the highest since 1983. Things are looking up for sockeyes, too, especially on the Pilgrim River. The red salmon had a near-record run there last year, and Menard says he expects to waive the limit on them again this year.
We start out with 25 sockeye salmon, but then we see the run's going to be good, and we'll waive the limit. So we've really went through that cycle of going up for a while, and then we crashed at Pilgrim, then we're going back up, and we've really seen a shift in effort from the Nome folks.
He says around 500 permits have been given out for the Pilgrim River in each of the past several years. The management plan will generally be similar to last year, with an eye towards protecting Chinook salmon. Most marine and fresh waters in the eastern Norton Sound will be closed to subsistence net fishing in early June. Dip and cast nets may be used, but any kings caught will have to be returned. Menard says commercial fishing for chum in the northern Norton Sound should open sometime after June 20th. Commercial fishing for coho in those areas could be expected in late July. In spite of the positive outlook, Menard says you should always be ready for anything.
The ocean tends to be a big black box out there, so sometimes you do get a surprise. Overall, we had an incredible year last year. We'd like to get two in a row. We'll see how it plays out, though.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Gabe Colombo.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
One of Skagway's main tourist attractions is out of service. White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad suspended service after a rock damaged a bridge earlier this week, about 7 miles up the railroad track from town. White Pass official Tyler Rose says service should be restored in the next few days.
There was a rock strike on the bridge, and we're suspending service until we can have an assessment and make the necessary repairs.
At maximum, White Pass runs around 12 trains per day with about 500 passengers per train.
Our crews are mobilizing up there, and we hope to have this repaired as quickly as possible and restored to service.
Skagway had 4 ships in town yesterday that brought nearly 10,000 visitors. Sophie Woods has worked at Dillingham Elementary longer than anyone else at the school. Over her 50 years as a teacher's aide, she's taught students a variety of skills, from reading to native dancing. Now she's retiring. KDLG's Izzy Ross has the story.
That one is silly.
At a class in early May, Sophie Woods sits with kindergarten students. They're coloring in line drawings of animals and insects, writing the names of the animals on dotted lines underneath.
I see a tadpole. I forgot.
It's okay. It's okay. Now you know.
Okay.
What does this say?
I see a bunny.
I love to teach reading. Joni Snowgrove has me teach language arts. This is kindergarten. We never used to do that a long time ago, but in this reading program, we have to teach them nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs. I have to teach them a verb. And I just love teaching them how to, I whisper in their ear. And I say, okay, you have to jog or skip. And then the kids will say, so-and-so is skipping or so-and-so is jogging. You know, and that's how they learn, by doing what a verb is. And that's what I enjoy the most.
First grade teacher Amy Ruby was Wood's student when she was at elementary school. She spoke at Wood's retirement party.
I've known her since I was since I was
grade.
6 years old. She has been an integral part of that school system, and she's been there for me. And she's been there as a student and as an employee and as a teacher.
Woods was born in Clark's Point. After living in New York for a few years, she came to Dillingham on a 2-year pilot program for teachers' aides. Woods stayed on for 50. After a period of administrative work at the school, she started working with students, mainly in the elementary school and occasionally in the upper grades.
I never did really teach bigger kids. It was just kind of like a bouncer. No.
That sharp sense of humor punctuates her recollections of working with kids over the years.
This kid didn't want to come to school. And his mom said, I'll just leave. And I said, go ahead, and I'll just hold the door. And I put my arms and my legs on the sides of the door. And he bit me.
Midway through her career, Woods decided to pursue a teaching certification. And she earned 72 credits through a long-distance learning program. But doing so while working full-time and raising 4 kids became overwhelming. She decided to stay an aide. And at times, that title was a sticking point.
Some people treated me as an equal, and some people treated me like I was a peon because I was an aide, and I wasn't a teacher. In fact, another Native lady didn't let me be in the Native Teachers of Alaska group because she said I wasn't a teacher. So, you know, I just let it go. I just stopped going to those get-togethers because she said I wasn't a teacher.
Still, she says that being an aide allowed her to develop a different dynamic with students.
You get to know the kids, and they confide in you because you're not a teacher. You're an aide, and they can identify with an aide.
Woods reached a turning point as an educator in 1999. A Native dance conference was taking place in Togiak, and the fifth grade teacher, Patricia Mador, told the organizers that Dillingham would send a group to perform. Then she asked Woods to teach some Native dances to her class for the conference.
I hadn't ever taught Native dancing, but I knew some dances. I had no idea how I would teach, and I just plunged in and taught them what I knew. I teach them how to drum. I teach them the songs. We just do it. And that's how Yupik people do it, too.
The group went to Togiak twice, and Woods has been teaching Native dance ever since. When President Obama visited Dillingham, Woods led students and the president in a dance. She says that dancing gives the students confidence. You can see their eyes light up, and it makes them feel good about themselves.
You don't just dance to dance. There's a story for each dance. Like the one that the president danced, it's a very simple dance. It's about a little boy going home, and there's thunder and lightning. When we're afraid of something, we say, a lie. The little boy, he's running home, and starts thunder and lightning, and he goes down to his qazgiq. Qazgiq means the mud hut that they lived in. And you have to go down to get into it. So the dance goes, a lie, a lie, a lie, a lie, a lie, a lie, a lie.
Woods may be retiring, but she doubts she'll stop teaching. She's considering leading a Native dance class for kids in the fall. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove in Palmer, Elizabeth Harball in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Avery Lill and Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Mitch Borden in Kodiak, Gabe Colombo in Nome, and Abby Collins in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.